We had a playbook that we had written down, and hospitality and retail was right at the top. As soon as the pandemic hit, we like sat down, the leadership team, and we said, okay, we got to figure this out and let's go look at some verticals that are going to work. And it was obvious to us, healthcare is going to take off. Delivery logistics is going to take off.
Hey, it's Adam Schoenfeld. Welcome back to the Built in Seattle podcast, where Seattle's top entrepreneurs, investors, and leaders share their stories and their lessons from behind the scenes. If you like this show, then you'll love my short weekly email, the Pike Street Journal. Subscribe at psj.email. Each week, I send some bonus nuggets from these interviews, stuff I get when the recorder's off, and some more insider takes on Seattle people and companies. That's psj.email. On this episode, I met with Yadu Gopalan. He's the CEO and co-founder at Esper. They actually doubled their business in Q2 at the start of the pandemic, and they're on track to triple in Q3. Yadu's a true builder, and you can hear that in this conversation as he followed his curiosity and passion to find the insight behind Esper. We talked about the process that led to creating the company, why he picked a co-founder that is his opposite, and the journey from 25 years at big companies to doing a startup. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm here with the one, the only, Yadu Gopalan. Welcome to the podcast.
Good to be here.
I heard that you only get 3.5 hours of sleep per night. What's the story there?
I do. So it's just kind of me. I do like kind of do late nights, and then I talk. Basically, we have an international team, all geographic located. So that's one of the issues. But the other part is just, that's really what I need. Might take a 15-second power nap there, here and there, refresh. But that's what I require right now to keep going. And it seems sufficient. We'll see how long it can last.
What's that look like with the international team? Are you on Zoom all day across multiple time zones, or what's the that look like?
I am. So it starts off at 7 o'clock in the morning or earlier if there's like an interview scheduled or something like that, where it's nighttime for them and I can catch up on all the work that they've done over the day. And so we have a bunch of meetings, and especially some specific tech meetings there. And then we after all those meetings are done, we turn over to US customer calls, meeting with the US team, all the other things that I have to do, meeting with lawyers, legal, investors, and then get a little bit of break around 3 o'clock, approximately 4 o'clock. And then it starts up again at 8 o'clock in the evening, India team again. And then that continues till like 11 o'clock or something. And then I need some time to do some of my own work. And that's when I spend till like about 2 o'clock, whether it's coding or writing documents or reviewing things. That all happens kind of at that time before I get tired to go to sleep.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys have been on kind of a breakneck pace recently. I heard that you basically doubled during this pandemic. Can you share whatever you share in terms of your public metrics and current size or growth of the business?
Definitely. So kind of do a little bit of rewind. And like when February came around, we had just raised. And this is after we had started our company in 2018. We'd released our product in 2019 after spending a year developing and talking to customers, et cetera. And when we raised January, February timeframe, we had about 20 enterprises using our product and about 50,000 devices. Like that's like kind of the metric we look at. Obviously, we still had not really gotten into the flow of revenue. Most of the customers had been with us about 6 months by then. And obviously, COVID came around February, and I just raised in January, and I had all this huge, great plans, and I was really scared and really worried, and we did some adjustments. But then we went ahead, and one of the things is, right before the pandemic hit, we had some industries such as hospitality, restaurants, etc., and we work across all kinds of verticals, but those are some of our big customers, and those things I immediately knew are going to go away. So really worried. then we kind of started doubling down. We said, hey, we work on all kinds of platforms, work on all kinds of verticals. And what really, one of the things that came out of this is, like, for us, healthcare took off, fitness took off, delivery took off. And these verticals really kind of made up for some of the loss of revenue from the other areas. And we actually doubled in Q2, and then we're looking to triple in Q3 in general revenue. And one of the key numbers that we're looking forward to is in the next 12 months, really the deployment of devices that are being managed by Esper is 250,000 and maybe even more. And so that's really exciting. And one of the things that I'm most proud of is like just the amazing customers, they're bigger, they're mature, super technically savvy. So all these things have worked out during this time, and I'm super thrilled about it.
That's amazing. And how did that strategy shift come together? How quickly did you have to rethink your verticals, and what did that look like behind the scenes, as the pandemic started to become a thing and you had to sort of rethink where you were focusing your business?
Exactly. I mean, we had a playbook that we had written down, and hospitality and retail was right at the top. And as soon as the pandemic hit, we like sat down, the leadership team, and we said, okay, we got to figure this out and let's go look at some verticals that are going to work. And it was obvious to us, healthcare is going to take off. Delivery logistics is going to take off. We already had some of this before coming in. We just kind of doubled down more on that. And then the other areas, like even education for us, has been very fruitful. Remote, like being able to get to students, remote devices there. All these factors really played in our growth here. And one of the things that for us that really happened is if you still have a business out there and you have devices, it's more important that you be able to manage these things remotely and deploy your systems remotely. So that actually played into our favor when as we were looking at these businesses. So it's somewhat strategy and somewhat is like we became a necessary infrastructure now as part of this new reality.
Once you came to those decisions about pivoting into new verticals and rethinking your whole master plan, what was the message that you took to your team and to your board at that point? You just had new investors, right? They just put, I think, $7 or $8 million into the company. You know, what was the message that you brought to the company when those changes needed to happen?
It was a little bit of evolution. We had our first investor meeting. So let me talk about the investors. And first investor meeting right around the said, no one, we were not quite, this was in March. And so we still didn't know at that time what it was early March. And so we'd kind of laid out like what we think should be a revised plan. And they're super open. I mean, they're kind of understood it. Like, I think I have one of the best set of investors that you could have. They're like, they've been including Madonna, who's come in and really understands our business and the opportunities we're going to have. And it's not like we're completely going away. It's just that we're reprioritizing this, the strategy of how we're going to do this. And then the other thing was, we also said, we're really an inbound company. And at this point in time, we said, like, we got to mix in our kind of our bottoms up inbound with a lot of this outbound, go call people, get this really, this kind of wheel kind of started turning and go reach out and find people a lot more. And that was another strategy that we added, and that's been really successful. And really worked out for us.
Yeah, it sounds like it worked amazingly well. So you said you doubled in Q2. Is that in terms of devices or revenue or what? What did you double?
Devices actually definitely doubled, and revenue too. Both of those metrics we doubled in Q2, and we're looking at tripling them in Q3.
Wow, that's incredible. So in that short time during the pandemic, you were able to go from like 50,000 to 100,000 devices out in the world?
Exactly. That's kind of the key. For us, it's also not about just even deployment. It's like roadmap. It's about what the potential these customers, many of our customers are going to deploy slowly, but they've got bigger targets and bigger built-in device base or etc. And that's what's really amazing. And like one of the things early on when we were doing right before the pandemic hit is we were talking about customers with their max device base of 5,000, 10,000. But now we're talking to customers who are saying, okay, we're going to deploy 50,000, we're going to deploy 100,000, we're going to deploy 200,000 in the next 12 months to 24 months. That's what's really exciting for me.
That's incredible. Can you talk about kind of a use case for Esper, you know, one of these bigger enterprises? What are the devices? What are they actually trying to do? And to that, you know, how has the pandemic sort of accelerated the need for your platform in their strategy?
Definitely. Let's take the healthcare kind of vertical. And this is actually a wide vertical for us. It's about putting devices in nursing homes, sending devices with patients so that they can leave the hospitals earlier. It's about putting devices, monitoring devices in the workforce, in your buildings, putting devices in hospitals. It's about maybe fitness devices. Instead of doing kind of recovery in coming somewhere and doing some like recovery, like exercise, et cetera, having them do that at home. So a lot of these kind of these enable people to do remotely, being able to monitor them where they are so that you don't have to have people come in all the time. So a lot of these things that are kind of contributing to this healthcare space. And all these use cases require, and especially they wanted to deploy really fast. So they require them to be able to deploy, then deploy their applications really quickly, iterate, get their applications out there, get the hardware to the location that they wanted as quick as possible. Then with whatever application quality that they had, which was, had to be good, but then they obviously wanted to iterate on this. So this, and without having to go there, and that's what we enable. And this is really kind of fell into what our vision was. And then monitor the devices, and when things go wrong, being able to diagnose all these things. And that's the kind of the value proposition that we bring to all these companies.
Yeah, it's almost incredible that this didn't exist already. I mean, it blows my mind. I don't have the industry knowledge that you have, but as these companies are deploying thousands of devices into the field, right, that they didn't have a way to manage it. Why wasn't this problem solved, you know, when Esper entered the market?
Yeah, and I think it's really about, again, one of those things is like when I started my career and I was building devices, we spent years creating CDs. And ship the CDs to manufacturers after a year of working on it. They would build it. And then these devices would really never thought about getting them updated. If we did have an update to the OS, et cetera, we'd ship them another CD, but it really got used for new devices that we're building. So that's where we kind of started, okay? And then kind of the internet connectivity and cloud connectivity came in. So people started adding some updates and some capabilities, et cetera. But that value really ended up being associated with like a platform like Google Play or iOS, iCloud update, but where you pushed it for everybody for that particular device and they all got it, okay? But dedicated devices are a little bit of a different breed. They're not part of this usually. They're isolated from this bigger infrastructure. They need to be managed really at a higher granular level. People don't want updates that will break their mission critical system unless they're really careful about it. So they want to control the updates. So they want to be the deployer of everything, not some cloud infrastructure that's out there. And then it's just, so this is basically where this is engineering teams building a product, putting it out there. And then they obviously, it's their product. They want to control it. It's obvious, it's they're typically, they still manage these devices completely. And this is exactly what, I mean, with the cloud, this is obvious. There is so much cloud infrastructure out there. If I have a service, I'm the person who controls when those updates, even if there are changes and patches to open source, it's not like somebody makes a change to open source and all of a sudden those things go to my service. I control that. When I do bring in those changes, when I put it out there, all kinds of tools out there. So that's the same level of control people who are deploying our devices want to have. And those tools just don't exist. And for devices, there are like other tools like mobile device management, MDMs that exist, but those were meant for like still, again, mobile devices that people brought into enterprises, their phones, and it's for IT systems to control what apps that could be installed on their phone. They're basically the BYO, bring your own device model, and what email configuration they should get, what VPN configuration they should get. Those were the tools that existed. So anybody who's doing dedicated devices either went to this, what I call tools, tool that really wasn't meant for them, or they had to kind of go build it on their own. And I think this is that gap that we're bringing the solution for, is a true solution, true DevOps solution meant for engineering and operations team building products and dedicated device products. And that's a key thing. And as a matter of fact, like the real small IoT systems that are out there that came to be during this whole time, they actually have a better operational and tooling than what I call smart IoT devices, which are a different form factor devices that were phones or tablet operating systems.
Right. So these are dedicated tablets or phone kind of form
phones factor. Or some huge 25-inch kiosk, or we've had people who are making completely built-in industrial systems with Android built into it with a UI. These are devices that are typically mission critical. They're revenue generating. They have either connect with a customer or an employee. So having these devices go down is critical. It would be high impact for the business. And the other thing is our customers deal with other businesses, and how they manage the deployments and the application is going to be really complicated. They may be sending something to this customer, a certain revision, this customer, a certain revision, certain features, and they have to manage this, and they have to manage this with not individually, but through an automated system. And that can kind of keep the sanity when they have all these versions and capabilities, et cetera, out there in the field.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a fascinating concept that the way people work in terms of cloud applications and all these other things had already made this transition. But with these kinds of devices, this class of devices that, you know, they were really working in this old antiquated way, it sounds like.
Exactly.
How did you find that opportunity where maybe others were overlooking it? Because, you know, maybe it seems obvious in retrospect, but how did you kind of arrive at this problem and get the insight for Esper?
So it's not quite the same in my different experiences building different device solutions. As part of that, I would actually also build infrastructure. And I worked with great big companies that had big engineering resources. We could afford to do this, and we could build our own infrastructure to do all of this and then go do the deployment, do the monitoring, et cetera. And sometimes I would do it over and over again. But one of the things, key things is while I was building this, everybody waited. Like they wouldn't have all the other developers would have to wait for good infrastructure to come in place. And so this is kind of the formative thought process. It's like, hey, this is something that is really could be useful, and a great OTA update, over the air update system for Bray operating system. And then the other thing that kind of in my thought process is like these working with dedicated devices, one key aspect is people are so scared of updating their operating systems. Even if you've got a security patch, they have no idea what it'll do. What is the kind of the impact to the system, and the best thing you can do for security as far as these dedicated, because you have full control. You're not running random apps on these things and you have control over it. But the best thing that can happen for this is better updates, intake of security patches, etc. And that just doesn't happen on these type of devices because they're just paranoid. And so what if I could give them a mechanism that they could push these updates, reduce their kind of cycle time even on their own applications by creating infrastructure that's a little bit more automated, kind of allows them to do early testing, continuous testing, and then reduce the blast radius when it does go out so they can much better. And so they can have the continuous monitoring of these updates and then stop it, roll it back, etc. That's something that was always in my top of my mind. It's like, how do we enable these? It's really still old school. Like when a device is frozen in time, And how do we change that? I think I worked on Windows CE 5.1 like 10 plus years ago, and there are still devices that people manufacture with that OS on there. It's just because that's the model this industry has been used to.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the questions you were asking yourself, like the what ifs and the how would I do that? And was there any question that you asked yourself that really unblocked you or really kind of got you to the point where you're like, okay, I need to go start a company to do this?
Well, there was two aspects for me to start a company. It's building the solution. And I spent all my time on devices and I was so focused on that. And then the last 6-7 years, I really got involved in learning about cloud infrastructure and cloud systems. And it was just pretty amazing to me how these things, there's so much tooling. It's almost like a Swiss Army style of things you can choose. There are so many companies out there building different levels and different grades. And it's just like, wow, this is so awesome. I mean, I can just like name off names of so many infrastructure companies that either give you deployment mechanisms, CI/CD, monitoring, that I can list. There's 10 companies that would allow you to do that. And you just pick and choose these things. And it was kind of eye-opening for me. And then, but at the same time, it's like, we go back to a device. Okay, I've got one infrastructure or one mechanism to do this, or I really don't have anything capable of doing this remotely. I have to kind of connect it locally, do stuff. If I want to debug something, I got to have them send the device back, connect it locally to a local network or to USB. How do I do that? And how do I do that in a secure manner? I wanted that capability that everyone's having to build and really build these fast cloud applications and bring that kind of thought process to devices. And that's really kind of the nexus of this whole thing from a technology point of view. And then there's a personal point of view. It's like, I just felt it was the right time. I had done a startup right after college that didn't really go anywhere. It was a bunch of engineers who did not know how to sell really. And then after these 20 plus years, it just felt right.
Yeah, I love that stat too, that you had done a startup right after college. Then you had, it was like 20 years at Microsoft, 19 years, then 5 years at Amazon. And then you kind of came back to doing a startup. Tell me about the internal debate in your head about, you know, jumping out to go do that after spending all that time sort of in bigger companies.
It was definitely something that I had to think about. I've always wanted to do this, but you know, the way it works is you realize, oh, it's 16 years, 17 years. And then the fact that I didn't even move from a single company and I didn't even move from a single team, really, I was just got really complacent. And then after spending some time at Amazon, I actually ended up working for 3 different teams trying to learn more about different concepts and areas. So that's kind of the thought, like, okay, I think I'm ready. Like I've done this for a while. Personally, my son had just gone to college, and it's like from a personal level, family level, and kind of even a professional level, it's kind of came together as the right time to do this.
But it sounds like you also had a deep passion brewing around the problem and the solution. Can you talk about how you developed that passion or how you checked in on that when it was time to make the decision of, oh, should I jump out or not?
Exactly. I think one of the key things, like in my, like I just really like building things and building different products, different solutions, etc. And I saw kind of like in the back of my head that there's this need, and that builder instinct for me kind of got there finally. And this is definitely, it's still, I'm super passionate about like devices and things that are just there and just work and like kind of autonomous and standalone. No one's there. There's no engineering resource anywhere in miles near it, and it's doing its job. And that whole thing is like super interesting to me. And how do we kind of make that happen in a better way? Is really about, it's like that's that capability. And how do I now take really this cloud infrastructure, because our product is really cloud infrastructure and devices, tie them together, because we to do all this, I do need to build a really scalable cloud infrastructure. And then I really do need to know a lot about how devices behave and have a great knowledge and be able to build, help customers build a good deployable system. So it kind of, that passion of trying, learning, taking my knowledge that I already had in the devices, learning a lot, spending some time learning about how to build scalable cloud systems. And then now I was like ready and to go marry those two together and kind of build this product. And the like, this is something that I've always wanted to solve. It's something that was super painful all through my life. It's like, oh, we've got this bug. How do I get it to these devices? There is no way. It's really hard. And you keep reading about it. It doesn't have to be even a security bug, this really bad bug. It's like, you'll still see these things. People on Slack or on these old devices will say, hey, this is happening here. And it's because there's just no way to get these things patched. And so even for my own stuff that I created a long, long time ago. And it's like, how do we kind of take that annoyance of these devices not being able to patch and kind of change this? It's going to take a while, but that's the mission that we're going to have, is like trying to get every device that's out there, these smart devices, being like updatable and being fully managed.
Once you had that passion like brewing and that curiosity developing in this area, what happened next? Like, what did it actually look like? Were you, you know, at your desk reading at all hours or out talking to people, or what happened that you kind of dug in on that curiosity and that passion in that time before you actually like jumped out and started the company?
It was, this happened really pretty quick. I think it happened in the first half of 2018. Was talking to my co-founder who I had worked with. He was part of the business managing OEMs like Nokia, et cetera, at Microsoft before he had gone on to work for Samsung and Cyanogen and these things. And we kind of started talking and saying that this would be a really good space. This would be a great solution to start off with. Early on, I mean, we kind of said, okay, this DevOps thing is probably really complicated. And let's start off with really a security aspect of this. And because we said, okay, this is a security play. This is a security play. And this is that's really how we ended up early pitches. But over the kind of, but it was a security play through a better operational infrastructure. But as we started talking to folks, it really, like, we could really make this a DevOps story. And part of that is being having greater security, not the other way around. But that was that early discussions and things like that, how we were going to kind of message this thing that we wanted to build. It was a little bit of an evolution early on. The aha moments happened actually after we started the company, a little bit more of like, this is exactly what we need for after talking to the customer, and this is the exact messaging we need to do. And it's still like a challenge, because we're in a new space, a new way of doing things. It's still a challenge to be able to go and take that messaging and go address it with customers. So, but that's a great challenge to have.
When you started those early conversations with your co-founder, how did your passion and his passion kind of feed each other? And how did you guys kind of get curious or dig into the problem together?
I think this is actually really key. And this is going back to the early startup that I did. The people that did the startup were all like me, exactly. We're a bunch of engineers. And one thing that came over is this, my co-founder is kind of opposite. And he's like kind of the sales, go after things really quickly. And things like that. I'm the sit back, let's build this thing. Let's think about it. What is the organization? But so it was a great conversation. And that one made like going back and forth on what we need to build and how we go to market, how do we kind of sell this to customers. So we had a lot of these discussions on that. And at the same time, we were pitching investors and then talking to people and things like that. But he was still in California, a lot of phone calls, fly back and forth. And so that's like we kind of evolved at a place that like we saw this. And he had been with Signage and Mode. He knew like what it takes to create a custom system, albeit for like a generic phones, and then takes a lot of that experience and learnings, and then I can take all the learnings that I have and how can we combine these together to form like what we wanted to do.
Nice. What do the actual activities look like in those early days, you know, when you're getting ready to start the business together, given that you had this nice complement in your skills and your experiences, like how are you kind of dividing up the questions or the work, or what did that dynamic look like in those very early days?
For real early days, for me, it was about going in. So once we decided we wanted to do this, I kind of took like basically it was the CTO hat and go build it, go hire the people. I flew down to even early on. We said we wanted to kick this off and create a proof of concept really fast. So I flew to India, built a team out there, and then spent time with them actually engineering, writing code. And then while he spent a little bit of time, early time, going and talking to customers, going to meetings, taking that vision and start trying to kind of do a litmus test. We were not doing any hard sell at that time. It's like, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about the space? What do you think about solutions that you have? What do you want? What if we built something like this? And again, we were still, this is where we were talking as a security first, DevOps second. And this is where we kind of started to kind of get in on the DevOps first. Security is not second, but security is part of the DevOps story, is kind of a DevSecOps. And so the real kind of satisfaction early was I'm going to go build the proof of concept, and then we're going to have this product come, and I'm going to come back, and then I'm going to fine tune this, and then we're going to start showing it off. And then that's at that point that both of us would go to customers and say, hey, this is the product we have, and then kind of test it out and get people slowly ramped up on it and trying it out for a while. And that's one of the things with infrastructure companies. Like, you got to build a certain level of a product before you can actually say, here, try it. It can't be just a few features. So it took us about a year to go build it to a level that somebody could actually try it.
It's incredible that you, from that year of building, how fast you've gone too, because now you've raised seed and in Series A. And what's the size of the team now that you have, you know, working on the company with you?
So we're about 60 people, 10 in the US, and then the rest is in Bangalore. We have engineering in both areas, both places, but there's a lot of engineers in Bangalore. We need, for our solution, we need device engineers, front-end engineers, back-end engineers, database. So we have to build a kind of a, what do you call it, minimum viable teams to be able to build this product. And it really felt the right way to do it in Bangalore. And then once we started growing, we'd start to expand in the US. And that's the phase we're in right now. We're hiring in the US. And then we added complementary, we have salespeople here, and then complementary people in India to take advantage of kind of the cultivation of leads, etc.
Got it. Yeah, it looks like you're really building out the whole go-to-market now. I saw you have tons of open jobs. So are you now kind of pushing the gas down on hiring and filling in kind of the team across all the functions?
Yes, to some extent. But the key thing is we're looking for people who can really kind of add to our talent. And it's really, like I always say, all jobs are open. Talk to us. If you're the right fit, and have the right passion and believe in this mission, let's talk. And there's obviously being go fast, but be frugal in the hire the right things, right? Like right people at the right time. But we want to really go fast on this. There's a lot of things to build. There's a lot of things to learn. We learn from our customers so much every day. And so I want to, on every vertical, every customer is at least at this point in time, different. They bring different, hey, I do it this way because they're all like, how do I either map what we do to what they have or say, hey, you know, that really makes sense. We should figure out how we can enable that model. So trying to get to a point where we can learn as much from different ways of doing things is key, which means get as many variety of customers that we can. So,
well, I'm looking forward to watching you continue to grow. It sounds like a great start. I want to wrap up now with the Supersonic Six.
Awesome.
So number one, how much coffee do you drink?
So for me, coffee is, it's not a count. It's a continuity. The first thing I do is get up in the morning, have a cup of coffee. And I think my last cup of coffee is around 11 p.m., 12 p.m. So I'm always drinking coffee. I add in tea in the middle every once in a while to mix it up. But I think I'm one of these people who can actually have a coffee and then 15 minutes later go to sleep. So it's not like something what gets me super wired that where I can't sleep anymore. And I don't do decaf.
You might as well just put it on an IV, right? And hook up one of your devices to monitor it.
Exactly. But I do, we have to be careful, but it's something like I've got a cup in my hand all the time.
Number two, what's one other Seattle company that you're following or studying right now?
Oh, lots of great companies and startups, but one company I think that really stands out to me, and this is from a relationship with one of our investors, is Auth0. One of our investors was actually one of the seed investors for Auth0 way back. So he introduced us and I met them, but I'm totally impressed from, like, there's this whole success part. They're like the unicorn, etc. But it's their culture that I'm like super impressed with, having visited. And like, this is one key thing that I want to duplicate. For if they have this, they have a lot of remote teams, and but every year they kind of all get together in one unique place, a different place every time. And they still do it even though they're much bigger. And there's these pictures on their wall where the first ones are in a lawn. And now the picture is from a drone where everybody's down there. So that's how they've scaled, but they're still doing that. But that's like kind of overall fits in this, like, we're remote, but we're going to try to figure out how to get together and meet and work together. And so it's just a kind of a microcosm of their overall culture and how they've built their team. So I love what they're doing and I love how they're doing it.
Very cool. Number three, who's one Seattle person that you're following or learning from right now?
Again, lots of great CEOs, lots of great startup CEOs. There's someone, I think it's famous, I mean, a lot of people might know, but it's amazingly not, people don't associate him like as a CEO. It's actually Andy Jassy of AWS, running basically a company within a company. I mean, AWS is huge and you don't like, but and it's, they've come a long way. But and one of the key things is like, he's actually created like this microculture of AWS culture within an Amazon culture. And it's actually, there are obviously things that they inherit, but there's also things that they're really unique to AWS. And it's because of his personality and because what he brings to the table. And there's lots of things like, you would think something like somebody like AWS wouldn't tolerate failure or something like, but actually no. They actually, part of his thing is like, you have to tolerate failure so that you can learn from it and correct it. What you don't tolerate is that same failure more than once. So how do I correct it really quickly? Understand the mechanisms and metrics and things like that. And then the other one is like, and I truly believe in, you hire builders who actually can invent, but also reinvent things and figure out better ways to do things. But that's like, I've seen him in action, but as I've done this whole startup thing, I continue to go back and see, hey, how did he do this? And I'm pretty impressed. But there's a lot of other like awesome CEOs in Seattle these days.
Love that. Number four, what's the one thing that Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub?
So here's a big difference, I think, between Bay Area and Seattle. It's like, I still feel Seattle is a two company town, Amazon, Microsoft, obviously, but then you can throw in the Googles and the Facebooks. And it's really a big company town still. And startups and smaller companies are just not in that overall visibility for people. The idea of going to smaller companies and let alone startups is still pretty foreign to Seattle. So there's obviously Bay Area has more funding, money, it's easy to raise, but I think we are getting there. Like companies like Madrona and everybody is starting to really focus on Pacific Northwest. But the other one is like, how do we get people to believe in like, hey, I should go to startup here, or I've just spent a couple of years in Microsoft, I should take a look at the startup. I think it's whenever I talk to all the CEOs and CTOs in Seattle, one common thing I get is it's still super hard to hire locally. And we go find somebody from Bay Area, move them over. It's actually easier. And I think I was reading about it's how a lot of ways of how Bay Area came to be. A lot of the startups and a lot of the whole ecosystem came out from the collapse of some huge companies. We haven't had any of those, not that I want anything like that for us. So we've got to have a different way of getting people to be kind of like thinking about smaller companies and what it is to work for small companies.
Love that. Number five, what's one piece of advice you'd give your 20-year-old self?
Oh, try different things. Like I think I said before is like I joined Microsoft before long and I joined this brand new team called Windows. Didn't even have a name, it had a code name, Pegasus. We're going to do these new operating system for handhelds. And that became Windows CE, Windows Embedded, Windows Phone, Windows everything. And I pretty much stayed there. And it was really insular in that fact that the .NET boom really passed me by. Linux revolution. We didn't spend any time outside of Microsoft. Like our thought, our mental, this thing, we never like looked around. And I think that's one thing that's changed a lot in Microsoft these days. And so I wish I'd at least change teams in Microsoft more often to learn different things. And even more, I think I wish I had changed companies to get different culture. Because one of the things I say is like, I learned how to be a dev at Microsoft. I learned how to be a leader, great manager, etc. at Amazon. And so I always feel like, what else did I miss out on?
Number six, what can this community do to help you right now? Do you have any jobs that you want people to put their attention on, or events, or anything you want listeners to pay attention to right now?
I think we're growing in Seattle, and we really need builders and seasoned leaders. And so as we grow, to kind of complement everything that we know, like on go-to-market and marketing, etc., is somebody needs to help us on that. And then obviously our product is pretty complicated, and we're going to continue to enable more capabilities, more features, more automation. Some people who can come and really kind of bring that vision to fruition is like, we're definitely in need of people who can help us do
this. All right, builders, check out their careers page. Lots of open jobs. Yadu, thank you so much for being here, and thanks for the time today.
Thanks. I appreciate it. It was great talking to you too.
On? I think it's on. Hey, it's Adam again. Quick note before you go. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying the show as much as I am enjoying making it. If you do like it, please leave a rating or a review. That would help other people find it in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you have any feedback, send me an email, adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com. No underscores, no periods, just adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com.